Our last case this morning, as Council approach, is A23-0285, Robinson versus Robinson. As you're getting settled, as I'm sure you're aware, appellant counsel will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondents counsel will have 15 minutes, and then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the podium and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
It please the court. Counsel, my name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Roger Gould, the father of the child with custody of the week. Let me begin by acknowledging that I have a wonderful fall Minnesota cold, which has given me very deep hacks. So I'm violating the rule of not having anything in the mouth during oral argument in the hopes of avoiding breaking into a coughing fit. So if I lose it at some point, my apologies in advance for the court.
No problem.
The issue in this case obviously relates to third-party intervention and third-party custody of a child. The statutes of Minnesota and the court decisions that have flowed from that statute set up a three-step analysis. And each of those steps is independent, and each of those three steps must be met. And if any one of the steps initially is not met, the analysis ends. So the first step is whether the proposed third party has established that they are an interested third party under the terms of the statute. And here, the only basis upon which the argument was made, and the only basis upon which the district court found third-party involvement was appropriate, was this notion of extraordinary circumstances. The second step of the analysis is whether or not the proposed third party has a basis within the petition and within the testimony at the hearing to bring the petition to intervene into the parent-child relationship. And the third step, which is only reached if the first two are met, is whether it's in the best interests of the child to modify a custody and allow the third party involvement. So let me turn to that first step. And I think each one of the steps, the district court compounds errors as it goes through its analysis. The extraordinary circumstances has been established by this court and the Supreme Court to be one which exists only in grave and weighty circumstances. And in fact, this court has gone so far as to analogize it to a termination of parental rights. One of the most significant steps state in Minnesota or particular county can take is terminating parental rights.
But that's not the case here, though. And I understand the analogy and the discussion in case law, but there was not a termination of parental rights here.
No, Your Honor, but the importance, I think, is that this court has recognized that the kind of reasons why you take a child from a parent, given the presumption that a parent is appropriate care for the child, is for those kinds of grave and weighty reasons that are the equivalent of a termination of parental rights.
Right, but I think I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But I think we have to be careful to not incorporate the standard for a TPR in terms of equating the two. And furthermore, the case law has said that statutes already incorporate the weight given to or the deference given to a natural parent. So that's already baked into those statutes.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the importance of the termination of parental rights analogy that this court has drawn is not that you have to prove all of the elements that go into termination of parental rights, but instead that the reason for which a third party can intervene into the parent-child relationship has to be something as significant. And what the courts have repeatedly returned to is this notion of child endangerment, which is obviously one of the bases on which you terminate parental rights. And so without the evidence of child endangerment, of remaining with the biological parent, here father, you don't have the basis on which to allow for the existence of an interested third party under the statute. So the first step of the analysis has to be, what is child endangerment in this case? And I submit to the court that there's simply nothing. The district court does not explain what it is that rises to the level of endangerment other than separating the siblings. Daughter has two siblings.
What case law do you rely on for the endangerment being a component of extraordinary circumstances?
Your Honor, both PLP and ALR both talk about the notion of child endangerment being necessary. And in fact, if we go to
I mean, certainly they talk about grave and weighty reasons.
If you go to Lewis Miller versus Ross, 710 Northwest 565. There, the court says that in order to have third party custody, the proposed interest in third party must show by clear and convincing evidence, quote, one of the following three child endangerment factors. Dismissal of the, and then it lists the three, including the other extraordinary circumstances. Dismissal of the petition is mandated if the petitioner fails to establish an endangerment factor, or that the placement of the child with the petitioner is in the best interest of the child. And remember, this is or, because you have to establish all three elements. So if you don't get, if for example, you treat child endangerment, but not best interest of the child, the third party, proposed third party still does not prevail in the district court act or prevail in the action. And so the or becomes a very important element to the Supreme Court's analysis in Lewis Mills. Here, the only element that the district court relied on to find child endangerment is, and if we look at the record, there's simply nothing in the record to show why separating the siblings for the purposes of parentage is going to have endanger the child.
But the district court also talked about the fact, which is in the record, and you know, your brief doesn't talk about it extensively, but the fact that he was convicted of child pornography.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he had very significant restrictions placed on him, including with his own child, including the child that is at issue in this particular case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that order, that April order from the district court, laid out very specific restrictions as to what father could do and could not do with respect to child.
Yes, Your Honor.
And those were put in place to prevent any type of harm occurring to child.
And Your Honor, you then have to progress chronologically in the time period immediately prior to mother's death.
Right, and that order was still in effect, correct?
That order was still in effect, but the parenting time expediter, mother and father, all agreed to unsupervised visitation.
Who cares?
Without any limitation on physical contact.
Who cares?
Well, Your Honor,
why does that matter? I mean, if you have a district court order in effect, that has to be followed, right?
Well, Your Honor, we have district court orders that are followed and not followed every day in the state.
But
the problem that I have with that analysis is that it ignores the reality. And we can say you are not supposed to do the following three things, but all three of them occurred. And so then the question becomes, is there any evidence that shows that during those visits, when father had unsupervised visits and unlimited physical interaction with his daughter, did any harm occur to the daughter?
Okay, so let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's assume there are two parties in a domestic relationship, and you've got husband and wife, and wife has been beaten by father, physically beaten, emotionally abused, extensive abuse has occurred. And so mother seeks a no-contact order. This court orders a no-contact order, orders father or orders husband to have no contact whatsoever with wife, stay away from her, don't go to her residence, don't go to her place of work, and he violates that no-contact order. Is it proper, is it right for husband to now argue that the contact that he had in violation of the discord order, he never abused her, he never harmed her, he never assaulted her?
Your Honor, I...
To argue that he shouldn't be held in violation of that...
Well, Your Honor, I think the missing element of the hypothetical and the distinction between your hypothetical in this case is mother agreed and apparently had an expedited...
But the record...
Your hypothetical...
But the record showed...
If picked up the phone and called up and said, come on over, let's have dinner together as a family, and husband does...
Okay, so let's assume,
and then again.
Hold on a second. Let's assume the husband and wife, wife calls up husband and says, come on over for dinner. And he violates the no contact order. Is he still in violation of that no contact order?
Sure, yes.
Okay, so that's the same thing here then,
no, right? I mean, the question though, or the issue then is, what is the consequence of that? Okay. She asked me to come over, may or may not be a defense, for example, of a criminal charge is brought for violating the harassment restraining order. It may or may not be a defense if there is a later kind of civil claim of some sort or a request to extend the harassment restraining order. There are lots of circumstances that might lead to husband and wife, or the fact that wife is the one allowing the relationship to be established and to go forward with that relationship, that would become material to various kinds of legal issues that might arise later.
But don't you have an issue here? Because the record shows that mother here, before she passed away, actually expressed concerns about unsupervised visits, but was concerned that because the PTE said he can have it, she was concerned that she would get into trouble with the court, not completely understanding that the district court order still was in existence and still controlled.
I think, Your Honor, all three of the parties to that discussion, father, mother, and the PTE, believed that the parenting time expediter had the authority to expand visitation.
But as a legal matter, that was erroneous.
As a legal matter, that's wrong, Your Honor. But again, as the prior argument went along, one of the issues was, what's a lay person to do?
Follow the law?
Expediter says, I have the authority to do this. You have the authority to agree, and in fact, the statute gives them that authority. But the parenting time expediter says, you have the authority to agree. And mother says, all right, I'm going to agree. I'm reluctant. Wife may be in her hypothetical. Wife may be reluctant having husband come over the first time because she's a little worried what's going to happen. But things go well. Then there's a second invitation. Things go well. Then there's a third room.
And then he kills her.
Well,
like everything else, it's whether the reliance is reasonable. And at the very least, if you think the parent time, if you are unsure as to whether the parenting time expediter has the authority to do something or not, the prudent thing to do is call your lawyer and say, hey, you know, the judge's order said this, but she's saying this. What do I do? Did that happen?
Not in this record, Your Honor. To the best of, I mean, within the confines of this record, there's no indication that anybody, the parenting time expediter, the mother, or the father went back and looked at the court order to see what the limitations were on the PTE's authority or the ability of the parties to stipulate to something outside of the court order or ask a lawyer about it or anything else. Certainly that, I mean, we would all like to think that people would pick up the phone and call a lawyer, but the practical reality is lawyers aren't inexpensive creatures and people don't tend to run off to lawyers all the time when they're comfortable even if a little reluctant, that they are comfortable allowing something to occur. And so here, mother, however reluctant she may have been initially, allowed the ongoing contact to occur and, in fact, to expand over time, to overnights. If mother had any concerns at all, I would submit to this court that she never would have allowed an overnight visit, but she allowed weekends. So again, if we go back to the, I think it's important that the court keep in mind this three-step statutory construct. And even if one looks at the situation,
I'll let you finish your thought.
The elements are not here for each of those three steps. There's simply nothing here to establish a basis for child endangerment. Nor, if you look at the elements of the intervention by a third party or the best interest of the child, does anything reach the level necessary in this case?
Thank you. And you will have rebuttal. Counsel for the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Perry Berg. I'm the attorney for the respondents, Casey and Tracy Robinson, who were awarded the custody of this child. I disagree with counsel's arguments that endangerment has to be shown in this case. I didn't see that in the case law that I was reading. And the seems like the main issue and their main argument is that we haven't met the standard for third party to be considered a interested party. And you know, we do concede that we went on the theory that these were extraordinary circumstances in this case. The statute itself doesn't define what extraordinary circumstances are. There's plenty of case law that discusses it, but there's a reason to have that in the statute, and this seems like the perfect case to have an exception for extraordinary circumstances.
So what are the extraordinary? What are the extraordinary circumstances?
First of all, the mother, this child is about 8 years old, has been living with a family of three sisters. Her siblings were just a couple years older than her. So we've got a family unit of a mother, three sisters that have a very close relationship. The father hasn't been involved in the child's life for 7 of the 8 years, I think is very significant. Mother dies of COVID in October of 2021. Very traumatic situation and circumstance for this child. That is the only parent that the child really knows. The father hasn't been involved in the child's life for 7 out of those 8 years. So she had to turn to only her sisters. Those are the only people that she really has a close bond with. So the extraordinary circumstance in this case is a lot different than most of the other cases where grandparents bring a third-party custody case, is that the father's not involved, and we don't want to tear this child, this 8-year-old child, away from her two older sisters that she's bonded with and needs at this critical time in her life. The other thing is that the brother who stepped in, brother and sister-in-law who stepped in requesting custody, had custody of the two older siblings that, again, older, but just within a number of years of this 8-year-old child. The father of the older two girl siblings was not involved in the girl's life whatsoever, which hasn't been part of the dynamics of the family, wasn't interested in getting custody. So my clients took custody. So that is extraordinary. You don't usually have that set of circumstance. That makes it very important for...
But the cases we have seen, the grandparents' cases or the other cases, the child had been living with those grandparents or the aunt and uncle at the time. I mean, does that make a difference in this case as to why it's not as extraordinary as you would have us argue or believe?
I don't think so, because the father hasn't been involved in the child's life. You know, if the father had been having regular parenting time over that 7 years and had a good relationship, was bonded with the child, no issues with sex addiction, meth addiction, even after he was convicted of 5 counts of child pornography, he continued to solicit underage girls for sex. There's some testimony and evidence in the record that he did that for like 10 different females after he was convicted of pornography. So I think it's quite a bit of difference. That's how you can distinguish those cases. And I think it's a big factor that...
But I mean, would you concede, would you concede, Mr. Berg, you know, father now apparently, you know, has gotten his act together. He seems to be not offending. He seems to be sober. He seems to be off the alcohol and the meth. I mean, he seems to have done all the things people want him to do. I mean, would that be a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
But it's just too late. Is it just, is your argument is, well, you know, tough. It's too late.
Right. Yeah, for 7 years, he ignored his child. And now the last minute, and you know, and if mom had lived a couple more years or something and they established this every other weekend unsupervised parenting time, that might make a difference too. But the real issue here is that he only had unsupervised time with this child for 11 months before mom died. That's a very short period of time for him to establish if he could even parent.
But I mean, your argument is that he has been absent from the child's life for 7 out of 8 years. I'm not sure if that's completely accurate. I think the record does show that he did have interaction. And in particular, it's been an upward trajectory in terms of the amount of time that he has spent with child.
I would agree with you somewhat on that. He had a number of court orders where he attempted to get parenting time, and it was very limited to like 1 hour a week, but he didn't actually exercise that most of the time. And really, I think the child had to be about 6 years old. He had supervised parenting time with the CADA, the CADA terminated because the child wasn't capable of having that relationship with the father. She just didn't know him at that point in time. And said that she wasn't mentally prepared to have a relationship or to have parenting time with the father. And that was only like within a couple of years.
Does this child have any special needs of any kind?
There is testimony evidence that she had some special needs, that she had anxiety, she had depressive moods, and she had, one other mental health issue that was a concern of the child therapist and the guardian litem, who both in this case testified that it would be detrimental and harmful for the child to be separated from her sisters.
As I recollect, I believe that the child expressed a preference to stay with the aunt and uncle as well.
Yeah, through the analysis of the guardian litem and the child therapist, she stated a preference to stay with her sisters and not to be with her father, but she did want to have visitation with him, you know, the standard every other weekend. She was comfortable with that, but nothing more than that. The judge did find that the child was of sufficient age and maturity to state that preference too.
But did the child state that preference to before the court? I mean, my recollection is that was just stated to the guardian ad litem. So that wasn't... I mean, is that a preference that can even be relied on properly?
Well, the court relied on the guardian ad litem and the child therapist, and those are the experts in the case. And I think both of them had indicated the child, you know, was credible in stating that preference.
I'm sorry, you said the child had expressed that to the guardian ad litem, and who else?
There's a child therapist.
Oh, the therapist. Okay, thank you.
Right. But I think the court certainly did abuse its discretion. When you look at the 8 factors, assuming that you get beyond the fact that my clients are third party interested party, The other factors, of course, we'll look at before you go on to the best interest factors. They're very similar.
They are. And I, before you get to the best interest factors, I do want to go back to the first part, interested party and extraordinary circumstances. Let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with panel that you do have to show endangerment. What are the endangerment findings that support the district court's order?
Well, I would say that it's the removing the child from the close bond that she had with her two sisters. If you remove her from that, then she's going to suffer some of these mental health issues with anxiety, depression, being removed from that bond in place with somebody she really doesn't know that well. I mean, that would be harmful to the child. That would be endangerment. And you're also placing her with somebody that has a, you know, fairly substantial history of sex addiction and improper sexual impulses with young children. And so there's certainly a risk there that you could be harming the child from that standpoint.
And he went through treatment, did he not?
He did go through...
And he was successful in that?
Well, he went through kind of fancy treatment and he appeared to be sober. There's no evidence he wasn't sober.
He went through...
But with the... sex addiction, he did go through that, but while he was on probation and after treatment, it's documented that he continued to solicit underage girls.
I was curious about that. Was he ever charged, or was there a probation violation hearing, or how did that come out?
No, there's nothing on the record of that. It came out in, I think, some of his therapy with his part of the sex addiction, the therapy you had to do. We met with a therapist and it came out with that therapist. The therapist, I believe, shared that with the probation office, but as far as I know, they did not try to violate him for that.
So they didn't think that was significant to take any action, apparently.
I don't know what they thought, but they didn't take action on it, but it certainly was a concern for the mother. In this case.
Right. But he went on, it looks like he successfully completed the sex offender treatment.
He was successfully discharged from the program.
Yeah. Okay.
Can't deny that.
And just to clarify, he's remained sober. He hasn't had any relapses for a number of years. And I think he had testified at some point that his underlying addictions were part of the basis and tied to is sex addiction as well.
Right. No, he hasn't relapsed that we're aware of. He did testify at the trial. I think I asked him both about the chemical dependency, but more about the sex addiction. And he did testify that you're not cured. You know, I'm managing it. You know, so you're managing it, but when something happens in your life, you know, that you can pull off the wagon, you can resort to your prior conduct would be the concern on that. Counsel made a few statements that the mother had agreed to the unsupervised parenting time, and I think the record is, it misstates the record somewhat because she was very reluctant to do that. The PTA knew she didn't have the ability to award unsupervised parenting time. I mean, PTE should understand what the court order says. The court order was very clear that she had the right to meet with these people to work out a parenting time arrangement, but because she had to do that consistent with what that court order was. The court order was you could only have supervised parenting time, along with a long list of things he could not do with the child in the court. Mentioned that in the record already, he couldn't touch her buttocks, he couldn't hold her in certain ways, he could only kiss her on the forehead, he could only hug her certain ways. And there were a number of things that he was not supposed to do to help protect this child from harm. He did testify at the trial that he didn't think those were in place yet, so when he was having any contact with the child, he could have been violating the court order and putting that child at risk. That's all I have, unless you have a question.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Berg. Mr. White, you'll have the last word, sir.
May it please the court, counselor. Let me get back to the child endangerment issue, since I think it as the case law establishes, it's a critical threshold here. First, it's important to go back to the district court basis on which the district court reached its decision. And if you look at paragraph 3, and specifically paragraphs 3.4 and 3.5, which are A6 of the addendum, there is no mention in that finding about the interested third party statute of the past criminal or history or drug use history of Mr. Gould. The district court itself did not rely on that, relying instead, and this is why the emphasis in my brief, Your Honor, on the nature of the siblings and the supervised versus unsupervised parenting time issue with the violation of the existing court order.
Let me ask you, is the presumption is not absolute that a parent gets custody of a child, right?
True. Okay. It's just a presumption.
So in looking at the district court's decision, we have to give deference to what their findings are. True?
Factual findings, yeah.
Okay. And there's nothing specific about the extraordinary circumstances. There isn't anything specific that I've saw that says you have to have a certain set of facts to find extraordinary circumstances. So isn't a question of how much discretion the district court gets?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I think that's a critical distinction between a factual finding, which this court looks at for error, versus whether or not a particular statutory requirement is met for which this court looks at the issue for an abuse of discretion. And those are obviously very different standards. Here, the district court abused its discretion in finding child endangerment because there's simply nothing here.
But does the district court have to find child endangerment?
Yes.
And you relied on the Lewis case, right?
Among others, yes, Your Honor. I think there's about four or five of them we cite in our brief.
But you're saying there's no other circumstance that could be considered by a court except child endangerment.
That's the way this court and the Supreme Court have interpreted the statute. Now, obviously, the phrase other extraordinary circumstances is not defined. So this court can add to other extraordinary circumstances if it chooses to do so, presumably, subject to the Supreme Court taking a look at it. If you're going to take that step, however, I would ask the court to publish the opinion so everybody out there in the world knows that you are changing the law. You are adding to the legal standard. And in fact, there is no argument from even the respondent that endangerment is not necessary. If you read the brief, there's no argument that endangerment is not the standard that we're dealing with here. And so what is it that we have that reaches to endangerment? If you look at paragraph 5.4 of the court order, the judge specifically finds child enjoys time with their father. If you look at the Walden decision from Minnesota Supreme Court a long time ago, the Supreme Court expressly said, we are not prepared to create law that says that merely separating children as we go from unblending to blending to reblending families is the kind of extraordinary circumstances that are necessary in order to take particular action and take a child away from the parent.
But that wasn't the only factor, and you're looking at the best interest factors. It seems the child's preference is a fairly significant one. There are a number of factors that the district court went through and made findings to support.
Yes, sure. But I'm not going there. We can go there if you want. I've been at 26 seconds. But I'm not going there. My argument is that Wallen establishes that it is not an extraordinary circumstance to separate citizens. We do it all the time. We separate them, we bring them back together again in this blended family society in which we live. And for this court to say
keeping children together is an extraordinary circumstance, I would suggest is an extraordinary ruling, and one that has all kinds of perils to it that we don't have the time to get into. So, Your Honor, finally, no addict I know of any variety, will tell you that they're cured. If they do, they're lying to you. And addicts and treatment professionals will tell you that they're lying to you. You're never cured. I'm good for today. I'm good for tomorrow. I will be good for tomorrow. And that's all an addict will tell you, and that's all Mr. Gould's told the court in this record. So, Your Honor, we would ask the court to reverse the case and remand it for whatever additional hearings are necessary in order to establish reasonable visitation for the Robinsons, and if they wish to have a specific date and time visitation between siblings to get that established as well.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Thank you, Mr. White. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.